This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Leadership on the Line, Staying Alive Through the Dangers of Leading by Ronald A. Heifetz and Marty Linsky. Narrated by Jack Garrett. Preface. Adaptability has been an essential ingredient for surviving and thriving for every species of life, from life's beginning on Earth. This has surely been true for human systems trying to meet difficult challenges and flourish in the face of uncertainty and change, for whatever forms that system takes. Global networks, a nation, a tribe, a town, a company, a family, or a person. So if your community, at whatever scale you define it, needs to focus on enhancing one skill set, one capacity, one competency to help ensure going forward successfully, choose adaptability. And what holds for any human system, we think holds for you as an individual as well. Now, more than ever. We wrote this book with three goals in mind. One, to show that productive change must be adaptive to be sustainable. Two, to offer tools and frameworks that lower risk so people can see how to lead and stay alive through the dangers of change. And three, to encourage people to seize opportunities to exercise leadership that are within reach every day. While the need for adaptability has always been critical, never has its significance been as front and center as it is today. People everywhere are having to figure out how to adapt to the multiple daunting challenges facing the world. Stateless and state-sponsored terrorism, wars and refugees, the effects of climate change and the violence of storms, flooding of coastal cities and drought, the dangers of new viral pandemics, population growth that exceeds the carrying capacity of families and economies. The internet and its social media offspring have changed how human beings communicate with each other, how war is fought, and how politics are played. The Great Recession that began in 2008 not only threw the worldwide equity markets into freefall, but led to a recovery that fell unevenly, widening further the income gap. Politically, the United States elected its first African-American president, yet polarizing movements emerged in the world, on both the left and the right, often entering and upending mainstream electoral processes. Elections in democratic settings in Asia, Australia, Europe, South America, and the United States have been won or nearly won by politicians with authoritarian inclinations and an appeal promising easy answers and a restoration of order, predictability, and calm. The key word in President Trump's 2016 campaign mantra, "Make America Great Again," was again. The desire for restoration, to take one's country back, whether you share that yearning or not, is a pushback against the difficulties and hardship of adapting to new, unfamiliar, often threatening realities. The constancy, complexity, and depth of the change challenge all of us. On one hand, we face extraordinary new opportunities to thrive individually and collectively. On the other hand, with deep change comes loss, people left behind, long-held values questioned, beloved norms and practices undone, and the security of jobs, familiarity, and predictability gone. Simply and suddenly gone. All of this volatility has surfaced festering challenges in the world order and in the differential experiences of those people who were riding the waves versus those who felt they were drowning in them. Take population growth. A worldwide consensus on the importance of population policy has unraveled for reasons that we believe are only partly justifiable, with major impact on poverty, terrorism, sex trafficking, pandemics, mass migrations, and, of course, climate change. In many countries around the world, families, school systems, and local economies are overwhelmed by the number of children, rendering young men vulnerable to terrorist and criminal recruiters, and young women to sex predators and traffickers. Climate change seems intractable not only because, as consumers, many people are wedded to old jobs and old patterns of fuel and meat consumption, but also because, as aspirants, particularly in the digital age, huge populations of young poor people worldwide will seek to consume more. No longer will people find happiness in subsistence and isolation. Pandemics, too, are fed by the high density of people living close together. These factors have combined to strain the holding environments of all of our communities and societies, including those in the West, creating the trigger points of drought and floods from home, and migrations, epidemics, and terrorism from abroad. In Syria, for example, a high rural growth rate, combined with a long drought prior to 2011, led to a massive movement of farming communities to the cities and created a ripe context for civil war, brutal repression, the growth of regressive Islamic movements, terrorism, and mass migration. In leadership terms, these conditions too often generate yearning for authoritative direction, protection, and the return of order. Just as dictatorships in history usually emerge in crisis, the conditions of our times create a political marketplace for certainty and answers. Distressed citizens reward pandering, and politicians oblige. Politicians overpromise to win election and earn distrust because they cannot deliver. Inevitably, amid the adaptive challenges of these decades, people feel that those in authority are letting them down, not meeting their expectations, not hearing their pain, talking at them rather than listening to them. Feeling betrayed and increasingly insecure, many people angrily retreat into narrower identity groups. The strain on solidarity in diversity is palpable around the world. We need to break this vicious cycle. Citizens need to face the complexity and consequences of their demands, but politicians need to engage citizens more honestly and artfully to lead that process. It's not enough for officeholders to work hard to comprehend the issues if they then shield their constituents from tough choices. Profound change is more honest than grandiose, more incremental than the experience of it, and builds from the enduring values of individual human beings and the orienting values of human communities. We believe it's possible to lead and stay alive, to both win re-election and engage people to own their part of change in an iterative, adaptive process of renewal. The current human experience is deeply disorienting and disturbing, but deep, dramatic, profound change starts from somewhere, is more incremental than the experience of it, and is deeply embedded in values, the values of individual human beings, and the shared values of human communities. Leadership traps, the transformation dilemma. When we and our colleagues began 35 years ago to develop these perspectives on the practice of leadership, initially in Ron's collaboration with Riley Sender, and the seminal book Leadership Without Easy Answers, and subsequently here in Leadership on the Line, the term commonly used to capture the aspirational in leadership thinking was transformational. Transformation by itself is problematic as a frame for leadership. First, it encourages self-referential grandiosity. I have a transformational vision, and now I am going to sell it to you. Leadership seen in this light too readily becomes about me and my vision rather than the collective work to be done. The transformational mindset does not begin with a diagnostic focus and search process. The crucial step of listening to comprehend the gap between values, capacities, and conditions before formulating a path forward. Rarely does it encourage the quest for shared purposes. Far too often, the self-styled transformational leader begins with a solution and then views leadership as a sales problem of inspiration and persuasion. Second, by itself, The transformational mindset tends to be ahistorical. It tends to start with the change idea, perhaps a best practice, with little respect for the soil in which it must take root. Even if it is on paper a great idea, the importation of the idea risks uprooting more than it should, disorienting and devaluing people more than is needed, and in the end often generates a cultural immune reaction that rejects or distorts the original idea, regardless of one's good intention. The allergic reaction may happen quickly, Egypt, Yemen, and the Arab Spring. Or it may take 40 years, the Chinese Revolution, or 60 years, the Russian Revolution. Third, emphasizing transformational change alone encourages passionate and courageous people to seek big systemic change, but also risks encouraging them to rush to scale and discount the incremental and transactional day-to-day work of leadership. The world today needs adaptations at every level, from the way families raise children, to the way neighbors, consumers, and citizens interact, to the ways we operate across national boundaries and among nation states. The challenges of the 21st century need not a single savior, but everyday leadership from people mobilizing collective creativity on tough problems within their reach from wherever they live. Sustainable change is adaptive. We believe our times call for deep and widespread change that transforms people's capacity to meet today's challenges and thrive in new ways. We also believe that sustainable, transformative change is more evolutionary than revolutionary, conserving far more cultural DNA than it tosses out. For example, Google's search engine depended on and conserved an already evolved economic and technological infrastructure, the U.S. economic system, and the growing market for web-based products, a rich network of tech industries, the ecosystem of Silicon Valley, and many previous engineering solutions, including lessons from the search engines that preceded it. Google's technology transformed our human capacities in a sustainable way, because these deep changes took root in established technological, economic, and cultural competencies, institutions, and values, and built from there. And though Google's business model, based on advertising revenues and new data gathering techniques, transformed the online marketplace, much of it drew on essential lessons and conserved essential capacities that had already evolved over the course of generations in advertising and marketing. To take a historical example, the American Revolution conserved most of the cultural DNA of Great Britain, its language, arts, science, political theory, and the nascent free market system. A nation built upon values rather than ethnicity, enabling an architecture for diversity, was not only transformative, it was also adaptive. The founders conserved more than they changed. For transformative change to be sustainable, it not only has to take root in its own culture, but also has to successfully engage its changing environment. It must be adaptive to both internal and external realities. Therefore, leadership needs to start with listening and learning, finding out where people are, valuing what is best in what they already know, value, and do, and build from there. It's dangerous to lead with only a change idea in mind. You need both a healthy respect for the values, competence, and history of people, as well as the changing environment, to build the capacity to respond to new challenges and take advantage of new openings. Systemic adaptation. The Colombian example. Even big change led from the top of a government is the accumulation of countless daily increments and transactions. Over the past decades, Ron has had the privilege of educating and advising several presidents and prime ministers around the world, all of whom had high aspirations for accomplishing significant changes in their societies, and all of whom both succeeded and failed, depending on the issue. based in part upon their ability to think in evolutionary, adaptive terms about the demands of leading deep social change and preparing their peoples accordingly. President Juan Manuel Santos of Colombia began taking big but incremental steps toward a peace accord with the FARC even before his inauguration in August 2010. He began by building an ecosystem, a holding environment, for peace negotiations. He appointed as foreign minister the previous ambassador to Venezuela so he could establish a working relationship with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who had provided sanctuary to the Colombian guerrillas. Santos needed to persuade Chavez to change course and put pressure on the guerrillas to end the violence and move instead to the negotiating table. Santos also successfully reached out to Cuba, historic supporters of the guerrillas. Raúl Castro, too, changed course, not only by pressuring the FARC to negotiate, but also by offering to host the negotiations. And Santos brought in the Norwegians, who had hosted the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations and the Oslo Accords, to serve as a neutral host along with the Cubans. These were big moves, but they were also incremental steps. The negotiation process itself lasted more than 5 years. President Santos had a first-rate negotiating team, but he also established multiple lines of communication with the FARC to increase his options and maintain control over the process. Daily, he paid attention to the work of his negotiating team, the challenges and opposition of his political colleagues, and the difficult adjustments for various publics, as they each were being challenged to face the host of tough issues placed on the negotiating table and before the country at large. There were endless, big, tough questions, as narrow as the mechanisms for the confiscation of weapons and as broad as policies to tackle the inequity that gave rise to the guerrilla wars in the first place, 50 years earlier. Each required detailed, specific analysis and creativity, and significant changes in the hearts and minds of everyone, from the negotiators to the average citizen. That President Santos survived re-election in 2014 and concluded the peace agreement in 2016 is a testament to the detailed, daily, transactional, and dangerous work of nurturing deep societal change. Of course, the jury is still out. Santos lost the referendum on the peace agreement in October 2016, but adapted quickly, revised the agreement, and rapidly won congressional approval. To secure those gains in his last year in office, President Santos turned the focus of his attention toward the public's reparative work. For most of his time in office, he focused on the negotiation, with less time for engaging and building trust with relevant communities across the countryside. Everyone inside the negotiation process went through a deeply emotional change experience over years of intense effort. They were held well by Santos at every step, but the president was less available to hold those who would have to bear the brunt of reconciliation, the families of kidnapped and murdered victims, and those who would have to risk their political, economic, or cultural standing in the new political order. A sustainable peace is not achieved in an agreement. It's only achieved in the adaptive changes in people's lives as they lay their traumatic past to rest, gain new social and economic policy, and build new working political relationships. Peace will remain a work in progress for a generation, with starts and stops requiring highly adaptive leadership, not only from Santos and his successors, but also from people leading with and without authority throughout the society. President Santos won the 2016 Nobel Peace Prize because with courage, stamina, and political artistry, and with an evolutionary mindset and adaptive approach, he did something extraordinary. He gave peace a chance and strengthen the odds of its sustainability. Adaptation at the personal level, the stages of life. Adaptive work at the systemic level is equally tough as an individual. We are certain that somewhere along the way, you have had to cope with unanticipated and unwelcome new realities in your personal and/or professional life. The sudden death of a loved one, an unexpected divorce, an election defeat, the loss of a job, a health crisis, a business failure, a romance for which you had high hopes suddenly fell apart, a trusted friend betrayed you. Add your own examples to this list. The challenges of adaptation in any of these situations parallel those facing President Santos and the people of Colombia. What do you preserve going forward? What do you lay to rest and leave behind? How do you sustain yourself through the loss? What new behaviors, values, and beliefs do you take up and try on? For Marty, this has had a special resonance since this book was first published. More particularly, in the past few years, Marty has faced the challenge of adapting to the inexorable process of aging. Advances in health care, dietary guidelines, and the practice of wellness lifestyles has meant that everyone has the possibility of living longer and healthier than did the previous generation. There are two easy, lazy options. One, retire like the previous generation did, move to a warmer climate, play golf and bridge, read, travel, hang around with kids and grandkids, and volunteer, give back. Or two, keep on doing what you've been doing. There's a lot of systemic pressure to do that. Why not just stay the course? Do what you've been doing, what you are valued for, what you do well. The world appreciates it and pays you for it. And it makes you feel competent and useful. Not bad. Many friends are doing just that. The adaptive challenge, however, is the opportunity to see this period as a new, next chapter, not just same old, or just fading gloriously off into the equally glorious sunset, but as a whole new period of the journey, needing to be invented. What Mary Catherine Bateson called active wisdom in her recent book, Composing a Further Life, the challenge of figuring out how to take what you think you have learned and make it available to a wider and different audience, or in a different way than you have expressed it in the past. Nevertheless, Marty says that nothing he has ever learned, observed, been told, or experienced has prepared him for this phase of life. As his body deteriorates, and alas, memory starts to fade, he is constantly facing difficult choices. Give in to it, fight it, go with it, or try to fix it. Fixing it was always the preferred option. Now, not necessarily so. Try to avoid a back operation by giving up running, a central element of his self-identity. Going to physical therapy and doing 40 minutes of exercises every day. Hearing aids, cataract operations, no more long back-to-back plane flights, no more successive nights of less than 7 hours of sleep. Naps? Yikes. What to give up? What to hold on to? And of course, how to make best use of whatever time there is left. Emotionally painful prioritization processes. Unlike for humanity as a whole, for Marty, the end is known. How, when, and what to do between now and then are not completely within his control, to be sure. But retaining his sense of agency by framing a series of choices, one by one, every day, and making them through the lens of what is essential and what is expendable, has become his new, nearly full-time job. Our own evolution. As teachers and consultants, we saw that the responses to the frameworks and tools we laid out in this book pivoted dramatically after the Great Recession. Before that, the challenges of adaptation seemed to many people to be a nice-to-have, not a need-to-have. From 2009 onward, people's perspectives shifted. The capacity to adapt came to be seen as an immediate necessity, and for many individuals and organizations, a difficult and traumatic challenge. This realization led to the decision by the editors at Harvard Business Review Press to republish this book and to this new preface. HBRP strongly encouraged us not to make substantive changes in this edition. The book holds up well as it is, we were told. However, they also wanted us to reflect on what we have learned and to suggest in this preface some reconceptualizations you might want to take into account as you explore these pages. Our ideas about thinking and acting politically, Chapter 4, have morphed as readers, students, and clients have pushed us to be more expansive about how to use the ideas at the ground level. Some of this gap we began to address in our subsequent book, The Practice of Adaptive Leadership. Acting politically involves much more than having partners, the main thrust of the chapter. Acting politically means customizing interventions, tailoring what you say and what you do to engage each particular target population for your initiative. It means knowing that all people in their professional and personal roles profoundly identify with other people and therefore are best understood to represent others. People represent people. Respecting those professional and personal loyalties becomes key to finding cooperative options. Acting politically, then, requires deep empathy, understanding the story people are telling themselves and you, even if you think that story is foolish, so that you can meet them where they are instead of where you are. Operating in this way requires you to know what's at stake for the people they represent, for their constituents, and to be open to alliances with people and factions whose motivation, interests, values, and agendas might be very, very different, and even in some ways contrary to yours. And we have learned from our work over these years that orchestrating conflict, Chapter 5, is really a subset of the broader umbrella idea of creating a holding environment. Orchestrating conflict requires a vessel, bonds that can hold people together against the divisive forces that pull them apart. These bonds are both vertical and horizontal, bonds of trust in authority, and lateral bonds of trust called social capital. Wonderful work has been done by our colleagues in politics and sociology, negotiation and diplomacy, on the careful, detailed analysis of the structures and processes that build these holding environments. Leadership requires not only pacing and sequencing the issues themselves to contain division, but also tending to the holding environment itself to strengthen the bonds of trust and shared interest that make the losses of compromise and innovation worth sustaining. You can't cook without a pot to cook in, and leadership is as much about strengthening the pot and controlling the temperature as it is about which ingredients to add when. Many people tell us that they find it difficult and personally well outside their comfort zones to raise and lower the heat, especially to raise the heat, although they may realize that doing so may be essential to getting people to address difficult issues. There are many tools here, some more challenging than others, for raising the heat. But strengthening the holding environment provides crucial leverage. Similarly, skillful interventions, Chapter 6, involve giving the work back, not only tactically, but also strategically. Intervening to make progress on adaptive work requires experimentation, making an ask, and customization. This is a retail business, not a wholesale operation. But you also have to think strategically about capacity and context, both about setting and framing priorities, and about timing, pacing, and sequencing interventions in an arc of change over time. Finally, we say in these pages, chapters 7, 8, and 9, that self-knowledge and self-discipline form the foundation for staying alive. Not surprisingly, given the risks involved, we have found that people trying to exercise leadership are keenly interested in advice about survival. But we also find that people often undermine themselves by taking pushback, criticism, and attack personally. Self-awareness and discipline are relevant to the task of generating for yourself the freedom to respond with a non-defensive defense when the attack is personal, and with an expanded set of options when it is not. To effectively distinguish role and self, manage your hungers, and anchor yourself, you will want to know how to identify the default settings within you that are shaped by the loyalties you've internalized from your professional and personal life, and sometimes your ancestry. And you will then want to learn how to renegotiate the relevant loyalties that inhibit the freedom to see and respond more creatively to what's really in front of you. Rereading this book closely, writing this new preface, and making tiny word changes here and there has been a labor of love for us, an opportunity to reflect on our own experience and the dramatic changes in the world since it was first published 15 years ago. We are humbled by the testimony of so many people that Leadership on the Line has continued to be a useful beacon for them in doing the meaningful yet difficult work of leading adaptive change. For us, this experience has also been an opportunity to reconnect and reinvigorate our professional collaboration and personal friendship, both of which have seen some bumps in the road over the years. Adaptive challenges are with us every day. Reading, writing, lecturing, teaching, and consulting on adaptive change with so many people have not necessarily made us experts at doing it ourselves. Like the changes in the world, the need for learning never stops. Ron Heifetz, Marty Linsky, December 1, 2016. Introduction. Every day, the opportunity for leadership stands before you. A father gets drawn into the same old destructive argument at the dinner table, but one day breaks out of the pattern and seeks family counseling. An investment banker nearly closes a $100 billion acquisition, but confounds everyone by putting the whole deal at risk when she asks, "Can these companies create synergies fast enough to satisfy the investors, given the current talent and different cultures within each of the businesses?" A politician challenges constituents to accept responsibility for locating a prison in their community, rather than chant the same old slogan, "Not in our backyard." A neighbor watches the nice kid down the street getting lost in his teenage years, long after his mother dies, and organizes a weekly coffee for parents in the neighborhood in order to provide support for the father and his family. You sit through a meeting, watching people avoid the real issues, and decide that you will be the one who puts them on the table. Each day brings you opportunities to raise important questions, speak to higher values, and surface unresolved conflicts. Every day you have the chance to make a difference in the lives of people around you. And every day you must decide whether to put your contribution out there or keep it to yourself to avoid upsetting anyone and get through another day. You are right to be cautious. Prudence is a virtue. You disturb people when you take unpopular initiatives in your community, put provocative new ideas on the table in your organization, question the gap between colleagues' values and behavior, or ask friends and relatives to face up to tough realities. You risk people's ire and make yourself vulnerable. Exercising leadership can get you into a lot of trouble. To lead is to live dangerously, because when leadership counts, when you lead people through difficult change, you challenge what people hold dear, their daily habits, tools, loyalties, and ways of thinking, with nothing more to offer, perhaps, than a possibility. Moreover, leadership often means exceeding the authority you are given to tackle the challenge at hand. People push back when you disturb the personal and institutional equilibrium they know. And people resist in all kinds of creative and unexpected ways that can get you taken out of the game, pushed aside, undermined, or eliminated. It is no wonder that when the myriad opportunities to exercise leadership call, you often hesitate. Anyone who has stepped out on the line, leading part or all of an organization, a community, or a family, knows the personal and professional vulnerabilities. However gentle your style, however careful your strategy, however sure you may be that you are on the right track, leading is risky business. This book is about taking opportunities to lead and staying alive. We ask these fundamental questions. Why and how is leadership dangerous? How can you respond to these dangers? And how can you keep your spirit alive when the going gets very tough? We are both straightforward about the hazards of leadership and idealistic about the importance of taking these risks. Many leadership books are all about inspiration, but downplay the perspiration. We respect how tough this work is. We know too many people with scars to show for their efforts. We have scars ourselves and harbor no illusions. Yet we believe that leadership, while perilous, is an enterprise worthy of the costs. Our communities, organizations, and societies need people, from wherever they work and live, to take up the challenges within reach, rather than complain about the lack of leadership from on high, hold off until they receive a call to action, or wait for their turn in the top job. This has always been true, but may especially be so now, in the post-September 11, 2001 world of uncertainty and vulnerability. Meeting these challenges need not entail getting put down or pushed aside, personally or professionally. To adapt a phrase from Johnny Cash, we believe you can walk the line, step forward, make a difference, take the heat, and survive to delight in the fruits of your labor. Leadership is worth the risk because the goals extend beyond material gain or personal advancement. By making the lives of people around you better, leadership provides meaning in life. It creates purpose. We believe that every human being has something unique to offer, and that a larger sense of purpose comes from using that gift to help your organizations, families, or communities thrive. The gift might be your knowledge, your experience, your values, your presence, your heart, or your wisdom. Perhaps it's simply your basic curiosity and your willingness to raise unsettling questions. So first and foremost, this book is about you, about how to survive and thrive amidst the dangers of leadership. It's also about getting more out of life by putting more into it. We've written it for those of you who play it safe, because you can't imagine stepping out or speaking up without getting burned, as well as for the risk-takers among you, who know what it's like to get shot down when you challenge people to change. This book is about putting yourself and your ideas on the line, responding effectively to the risks, and living to celebrate the meaning of your efforts. This book is about our times, too. We live in a period in history when taking on the risks of leadership in your individual world is both more important and more complicated than ever before. Globalization of the economy, the necessary interaction of cultures, and ready access to information and communication through the internet make interdependence palpable. Hierarchical structures with clearly defined roles are giving way to more horizontal organizations with greater flexibility, room for initiative, and corresponding uncertainty. Democratization is spreading throughout organizations as well as countries. All of these movements create new opportunities for you to make a difference. This book is also about us, Ron and Marty. We have been colleagues and friends for 30-plus years, working and teaching together, sharing our research and experience, and exploring, testing, and refining our ideas about the demands of leadership in modern life. The more we talk and work together, the more we find our experiences and insights overlap. Ron first draws inferences about how the world works from music and medicine, and Marty from media and politics. What do these four diverse fields have to do with leadership? Music is about moving people, about striking chords that resonate deeply in the hearts of listeners. It provides a language for elusive but central qualities like harmony, resolution, timing, improvisation, creativity, and inspiration. Politics teaches that no one can accomplish anything of significance alone. The more challenging the problem, the more the people who will bear the consequences of its solution must take responsibility for working on it. Psychiatry opens up a greater understanding of the way humans contend with challenges, individually and collectively, and the media make us aware that the way the message is delivered and the identity of the messenger can often seem as important to making progress as the message itself. Perspectives and lessons from these and other disciplines will, we hope, add depth and color. As consultants, we work with clients from the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. As teachers, we work in and out of the classroom with hundreds of students at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, where each of us has served on the faculty for 2 decades. From these experiences, we have come to understand that many people operate at the frontiers of leadership in their personal, civic, and professional lives. We've been inspired repeatedly by those who take responsibility for mobilizing people to seize new opportunities and tackle tough problems. From the stories of our students and clients around the world, we have distilled and captured lessons that we now offer not as brand new ideas, but as guides to help you name, organize, and make sense out of your experience. A number of the ideas in this book were first introduced in Ron's earlier book, Leadership Without Easy Answers. And indeed, this book grew out of the last section entitled Staying Alive. In our subsequent teaching and consulting, people have found this issue compelling, calling for much fuller consideration. Leadership Without Easy Answers was intended as a theoretical framework for understanding leadership and authority in the context of adaptive change. Leadership on the line is very different in voice and character. We wanted this second book to be more focused, more practical, and more personal. We hope this book will be accessible, eminently usable, and inspiring in your life and work. Leadership on the Line builds upon our years of working with people from many nations and walks of life, from workers, managers, and activists, presidents of countries and multinational corporations, homemakers and parents working outside the home, generals and admirals, as well as lieutenants and privates, senior and junior executives within businesses and governments, teachers and principals, and trustees and clergy. None of these people sat content on the sidelines day after day. They take pride in their successes, but most carry wounds from the times they gave voice to a point of view that disturbed people. They all wanted their lives and their work to matter. In part one of the book, we discuss why leadership is so dangerous and how people get taken out of the game. In part two, we offer a series of action ideas designed to reduce the risk of getting pushed aside. In part three, we discuss ways that people contribute to their own demise. We offer ideas about critical, though often neglected, aspects of exercising leadership, how to manage your personal vulnerabilities, care for yourself, and sustain your spirit. Leadership opportunities beckon daily. We hope these lessons will help you put yourself on the line and stay alive, not only in your job, but also in your family and community, and in your heart and soul. Part 1. The Challenge. Chapter 1. The Heart of Danger. Maggie Brooke grew up on a small Native American reservation in which nearly everyone older than 12 drank alcohol. After sobering up in her 20s, she spent more than a decade leading her people toward health. Now a grandmother in her 40s and a tribal elder, Maggie counsels a steady stream of visitors in her home throughout the day. One evening, she told her visitor about Lois, the woman who first inspired her to try to do something about the alcohol dependency among her people. 20 years ago, I used to babysit for Lois, who lived in a neighboring band within our tribe. Once a week, I'd go the few miles to her community and take care of Lois's little ones. But after about 2 months, I started to wonder, what could Lois possibly be doing every Tuesday night? There's not much to do around here in these villages. So one evening, after Lois left to go to the meeting lodge, I packed up the children and went over to the lodge to find out what she was doing. We looked through a window into the lodge and saw a big circle of chairs, all neatly in place, with Lois sitting in a chair all by herself. The chairs in the circle were empty. I was really curious, you know. So when Lois came home that evening, I asked her, "Lois, what are you doing every Tuesday night?" And she said, "I thought I told you weeks ago. I've been holding AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, meetings." So I asked her back, "What do you mean you're holding meetings? I went over there tonight with the children and looked through the window. We watched you sitting there in that circle of chairs, all alone." Lois got quiet. "I wasn't alone," she said. "I was there with the spirits and the ancestors. And one day, our people will come." Lois never gave up. Every week, Lois set up those chairs neatly in a circle, and for 2 hours, she just sat there, Maggie recalled. No one came to those meetings for a long time. And even after 3 years, there were only a few people in the room. But 10 years later, the room was filled with people. The community began turning around. People began ridding themselves of alcohol. I felt so inspired by Lois that I couldn't sit still watching us poison ourselves. Lois, and then Maggie, worked on becoming sober themselves, and then challenged their friends, families, and neighbors to change and renew their lives too. Leading these communities required extraordinary self-examination, perseverance, and courage. Their native history was full of people, some of them with goodwill, who had forced tribes to give up familiar and reliable ways. And now these communities were being asked to change again, with no reason to think that things would get much better. Lois and Maggie were asking people to face the trade-offs between the numbing solace of alcohol and the hard work of renewing their daily lives. There would be no progress until they had put alcohol dependency behind them. But people found it extremely difficult to give up their way of coping, particularly for some intangible idea about the future. They had fought back before when others had made them change their ways, and they fought Lois and Maggie. The two women were mocked and marginalized. They spent years feeling out of place in their own communities, unwelcome at parties and gatherings where alcohol flowed, so ostracized that even holidays became lonely, solitary events. Indeed, for long stretches of time, they spent weekends off the reservation to find people they could talk to. They had put themselves at risk, as well as key relationships with neighbors, friends, and family. Eventually, they succeeded and survived. But for a long time, they could not know. They could have lost everything. Leadership is dangerous. In the early 1990s, Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, had been moving the country toward an accommodation with the Palestinians. Slowly but surely, Rabin was bringing a majority of Israelis along with him. But he also had deeply disturbed the right wing in Israel, particularly the religious right, by his success in getting the community to wrestle with the difficult and painful trade-offs between long-term peace and territory. The right wing refused to face the reality that they would have to give up land they considered sacred for peace. They tried to debate the issue, but they were losing the argument. So they began to make Rabin himself the issue rather than his policies. The result was Rabin's assassination. A tragedy, as well as a terrible setback for his initiatives. His successor, Benjamin Netanyahu, retreated, unwilling to push the Israeli people to face the costs of peace. Indeed, the period before Rabin's death marked a high point in the willingness of the Israeli people to decide among deeply held values which were most precious and which could be left behind. Assassinations are extreme examples of what people will do to silence the voices of frustrating realities. Asking an entire community to change its ways, as Lois and Maggie succeeded in doing, and Yitzhak Rabin sacrificed himself in attempting, is dangerous. If leadership were about giving people good news, the job would be easy. If Lois had been gathering people every week to distribute money or to sing their praises, the chairs would not have stayed empty for so long. If Rabin had promised peace with no loss of land, he might have survived. People do not resist change, per se. People resist loss. You appear dangerous to people when you question their values, beliefs, or habits of a lifetime. You place yourself on the line when you tell people what they need to hear rather than what they want to hear. Although you may see with clarity and passion a promising future of progress and gain, people will see with equal passion the losses you are asking them to sustain. Think about the times you have had something important to say and have pulled back, when you have tried and failed, or succeeded but were bruised along the way, or when you have watched the trials and successes of other people. The hope of leadership lies in the capacity to deliver disturbing news and raise difficult questions in a way that people can absorb, prodding them to take up the message rather than ignore it or kill the messenger. As a doctor, Ron faced this challenge every day. Every patient looks to the doctor, hoping for a painless remedy. And every day doctors have to tell people that their health depends on enduring the pains of change, in giving up their favorite foods, taking time out of each overextended day for exercise, taking medications that have side effects, or breaking an addiction to cigarettes, alcohol, or work. Ron saw a few doctors who were artists of the profession as well as technical experts. They had learned how to engage patients and their families in reshaping their values, attitudes, and long-standing habits. But this was demanding and risky. Discussions can backfire if they seem unfeeling or abrupt, and angry patients can find a variety of ways to damage a doctor's reputation. Ron saw many more doctors give little more than lip service to this part of their job, all the while complaining about patient noncompliance, a term doctors use to describe people's resistance to taking medicine and advice. In frustration, they would say to themselves, "Why do people avoid facing reality and resist following my instructions?" But then they would take the easy road, playing it safe by pandering to the desire for a technical fix, avoiding the difficult conversations rather than disturbing people in an attempt to change the ways they lived. Lois, Maggie, and Rabin had to engage people in facing a hard reality. Just as patients hope to receive a doctor's fast and painless cure, some Native Americans might place all their hopes on a new casino or look for a technical explanation for their pains, a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. And most every Israeli would prefer to have peace without giving up any of their ancient homeland. In each case, the patient, the Native American community, the Israeli people, people must face the challenge of adapting to a tough reality, and the adaptation requires giving up an important value or a current way of life. Leadership becomes dangerous then, when it must confront people with loss. Rabin, Lois, Maggie, and the best doctors mobilize change by challenging people to answer a core but painful question. Of all that we value, what's really most precious? And what's expendable? The perils of adaptive change. Leadership would be a safe undertaking, If your organizations and communities only faced problems for which they already knew the solutions. Every day, people have problems for which they do, in fact, have the necessary know-how and procedures. We call these technical problems. But there is a whole host of problems that are not amenable to authoritative expertise or standard operating procedures. They cannot be solved by someone who provides answers from on high. We call these adaptive challenges because they require experiments, new discoveries, and adjustments from numerous places in the organization or community. Without learning new ways, changing attitudes, values, and behaviors, people cannot make the adaptive leap necessary to thrive in the new environment. The sustainability of change depends on having the people with the problem internalize the change itself. People cannot see at the beginning of the adaptive process that the new situation will be any better than the current condition. What they do see clearly is the potential for loss. People frequently avoid painful adjustments in their lives if they can postpone them, place the burden on somebody else, or call someone to the rescue. When fears and passions run high, people can become desperate as they look to authorities for the answers. This dynamic renders adaptive contexts inherently dangerous. When people look to authorities for easy answers to adaptive challenges, they end up with dysfunction. They expect the person in charge to know what to do, and under the weight of that responsibility, those in authority frequently end up faking it or disappointing people, or they get spit out of the system in the belief that a new leader will solve the problem. In fact, there's a proportionate relationship between risk and adaptive change. The deeper the change and the greater the amount of new learning required, the more resistance there will be, and thus the greater the danger to those who lead. For this reason, people often try to avoid the dangers, either consciously or subconsciously, by treating an adaptive challenge as if it were a technical one. This is why we see so much more routine management than leadership in our society. The table distinguishing technical from adaptive challenges captures the difference between the technical work of routine management and the adaptive work of leadership. Distinguishing technical from adaptive challenges. Technical. What's the work? Apply current know-how. Who does the work? Authorities. Adaptive. What's the work? Learn new ways. Who does the work? The people with the problem. Indeed, the single most common source of leadership failure we've been able to identify in politics, community life, business, or the nonprofit sector is that people, especially those in positions of authority, treat adaptive challenges like technical problems. In times of distress, when everyone looks to authorities to provide direction, protection, and order, this is an easy diagnostic mistake to make. In the face of adaptive pressures, people don't want questions. They want answers. They don't want to be told that they will have to sustain losses. Rather, they want to know how you're going to protect them from the pains of change. And of course, you want to fulfill their needs and expectations, not bear the brunt of their frustration and anger at the bad news you're giving. In mobilizing adaptive work, you have to engage people in adjusting their unrealistic expectations, rather than try to satisfy them as if the situation were amenable primarily to a technical remedy. You have to counteract their exaggerated dependency and promote their resourcefulness. This takes an extraordinary level of presence, time, and artful communication. But it may also take more time and trust than you have. This was the box Ecuador's president, Jamil Mawad, found himself in early in January 2000, when he faced the prospect of mass demonstrations with thousands of indigenous Ecuadorians mobilizing to throw him out of office. His popularity had fallen from 70% approval to 15% in less than a year. With a country in the midst of a catastrophic and rapid economic meltdown, on the eve of the demonstrations, Mawad said he felt trapped. "I've lost my connection with the people." 1 year before, he had been a hero, a peacemaker. In his first months in office, he ended a war with Peru that had lasted more than 200 years, signing a peace treaty with great excitement in the air. But his heroic accomplishments were to be washed away within less than 4 months by the effects of numerous natural and economic disasters. El Niño storms, which devastated 16% of Ecuador's gross domestic product. The financial crisis that swept through East Asia and then Latin America. High inflation, crushing foreign debt, bankrupt banks, the lowest oil prices since Ecuador had started to export oil, and a political culture that had brought down 4 presidents in 8 years. On January 21, 2000, a coalition of military officers and indigenous demonstrators forced Mawad out of office, another casualty of the country's ongoing crisis. Mawad described the contrast between being mayor of Quito and president of the entire country. As mayor, the people welcomed him openly as he walked daily around town. During his walks, he could often get people to cooperate to solve their own problems, or he could apply a little pressure and resources to help out. As mayor, he had the advantage that people looked for local solutions to local problems and worked with him. He was in touch with them, and they with him. However, when he became president and had responsibility for the national economic crisis, the people wanted him to find remedies for which other regions and localities would pay the costs. The people did not want him to tell them they had to change. He made several trips abroad to plead for help from the International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and U.S. Treasury. He consulted many worthy economic experts at home, in Latin America generally, in the United States, and in Europe. He came to see that any practical solution would require each region and sector of his society to endure considerable pain, at least in the short run. Mawad said afterward, "I felt like a doctor in an emergency ward on a Saturday night, and the patient came in with a badly damaged and gangrenous leg. And from my medical experience, I had to amputate the patient's leg to save the patient's life. The family said, 'You don't have to amputate.' I insisted on amputation to save the patient's life, but I lost the confidence of the family. The family held me responsible for the patient's problem." As president, he grew increasingly distant from his various publics as he faced rising hostility, and focused most of his attention on finding the right economic policy to reverse the downturn. Yet his trips to Washington yielded no assistance. Countless conversations with policy experts prompted a variety of prescriptions, but no clear way out of the quagmire. Meanwhile, poor people in the villages found the price of food rising beyond their reach. Many flocked to the cities, selling their wares on the streets. As inflation soared, the unions became furious at the lost value of paychecks. The business sector lost faith, sending their money north to the United States and hastening the insolvency of the banks. Mawad made bold moves in response to the crisis. Ecuador would cut government salaries, reduce conscription into the army, cancel orders for the purchase of military equipment, default on its loans, freeze bank balances to stop the run on the banks and the draining of foreign currency reserves, and finally, convert its currency to the dollar. Yet the adaptive challenge was enormous. Even under the rosiest scenarios, there would be further job loss, more rising prices, and increased uncertainty before people would feel the benefits of an economic turnaround. The most brilliant policy solution, coupled with a rise in the price of oil, would not have stopped the ongoing disruption caused by opening the economy to a more competitive world. Although Mawad worked tirelessly to halt the falling economy, ironically, the public felt that he had disengaged. They were right in one sense. He had disengaged from them. To use his metaphor, he had performed the amputation because it was the best of the available options, but he did not prepare the family for what they would have to endure. Many surgeons could have done the amputation, but only Mawad, as president, could have helped the family face their situation. Spending most of his time working through the issues